sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is International Affairs Authority Professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver, discussing the Middle East, Russia, and China, among other subjects. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Our Mavena on Israel, Oshrat Borel, is off this week. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This has been a very difficult 10 days or so for Jews everywhere, but especially so for Israel and for all of us who love her. So much has happened in such a short period of time that it's worth recapping it all, painful as it may be. After the bodies of the three kidnapped Israeli teens were found early last week, brutally murdered and left under a pile of rocks, an Arab teen was also brutally murdered, burned alive a few days later, and the Israeli police arrested and charged six ultra-Orthodox teens with the crime, and they confessed. Arab riots took place in the West Bank and East Jerusalem in response, and then a video on the internet also showed Israeli border police brutally beating the cousin of the murdered teen, a teenage American from Florida, and more riots broke out. The Israeli roundup of Hamas activists and terrorists in the West Bank collected something like 500 prisoners. Hamas fired rockets from Gaza in response, perhaps, and then engaged in a competition with Islamic Jihad elements in Gaza to see who could fire more rockets farther into Israel. The Israeli Air Force bombed targets all through Gaza, destroying the homes of many Hamas leaders without killing many of them, although some Hamas terrorists and more civilians, including women and children, were killed. Hamas and Islamic Jihad rockets reached but failed to damage the rumored Israeli nuclear site of Dimona, as well as Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and even Zichron Yaakov in the north. Iron Dome missile defense batteries successfully shot down many rockets, while others struck unoccupied areas. Israel targeted Hamas leaders and killed one in charge of their rocket arsenal, but otherwise seems to be unable to reach Hamas military commanders who are holed up in tunnels under Gaza, probably. Israel mobilized some of its reserves for a ground offensive in Gaza. While various parties counseled restraint and de-escalation, the UN mobilized too, probably to criticize Israel. It's a mess. And for Israelis headed for bomb shelters on a regular basis for the first time in years, this is a very, very disturbing turn of events. Having just returned from Israel, before all of this came down, I can tell you that during our travels through the Holy Land in mid-June, it was as beautiful and peaceful as I have seen Israel in a long time. Actually, my last several visits to Israel in recent years have demonstrated that this has been a longish period of peace, tranquility, and prosperity. Ever since the completion of the border fence stopped the Second Intifada's reign of terror, and even after the failed Lebanon War and the last Gaza incursion, it has been pretty darned pleasant in Israel, with the sole exception, the specific areas of the south, like Sderot, that have continued to experience rocket attack. It appears that Israel and Hamas are now headed for another showdown in Gaza, with international condemnation all around. So, what's really going on here? In my opinion, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was pretty open about his motivations from the beginning of this current crisis, actually from well before it appeared to begin in June. As soon as the Palestinian Authority, led by President Mahmoud Abbas and composed of Fatah members, the secular leadership of the Palestinians, signed on to a cooperation agreement with the Sunni Islamists of Hamas on April 23rd of this year, red flags went up for the Israeli leadership. The Hamas and Fatah Palestinian groups have essentially been at war with each other for about 7 years, sometimes openly, sometimes privately, sometimes there have been agreements, but they haven't lasted. This agreement was seen by many as a desperation move by Hamas. Hamas is rightly discredited as a terror organization, and it has lost all of its principal sponsors, allies, and backers, like Egypt, because of regime change and internal problems. With Gaza an economic disaster and with Hamas unable to competently manage such basics as sewage and unable to pay its own employees, many of the military and police who are trained to attack Israel, Hamas decided it needed to reach out to Fatah. Abbas, the leader of Fatah, saw the John Kerry peace efforts collapse, predictably, and needed to shore up his own standing with his people. And so the Hamas-Fatah agreement to share power, with Abbas as the titular head, theoretically empowering Fatah over Hamas and allowing Fatah to send some police and other officials into Gaza for the first time since Hamas expelled them 7 years ago, throwing some of them off of high buildings. Bibi Netanyahu and other Israeli security officials were certain that this was actually a new strategy for Hamas, formed in Iran at some of their meetings there, and that Hamas would now attempt to take over the West Bank, using this new agreement as a way in. Hamas would work for political ends, seek to get elected to the leadership of the whole Palestinian Authority, and thus gain control of the military elements of Fatah. This was the worst possible scenario for Israel, in their view. Hamas, as a beaten, trapped terrorist group trying and failing to successfully run Gaza, was much better for Israel than Hamas eventually taking over the West Bank and Gaza by political means and presenting a much more formidable threat to Israel. While Hamas has limited rocket attacks from Gaza dramatically the last couple of years, ever since the last ceasefire with Israel, no one in Israel believes it is capable of or interested in anything but the ultimate destruction of the Jewish state and the slaughter of all Jews. The murder of the three yeshiva boys, in my opinion, was likely not a formal Hamas operation. There are many other Arab extremist terror factions within both the West Bank and Gaza, and some are much more extreme even than Hamas. There is Islamic Jihad, another offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. The leadership of Israel suspected the boys were dead shortly after being kidnapped, but they did have the obligation to search everywhere for them. While they were at it, they rounded up a large proportion of the leadership of Hamas in the West Bank. While the Palestinian Authority has kind of protested and Mahmoud Abbas has made sweeping public pronouncements, in effect, the Palestinian Authority and Fatah have been very, very careful not to make a big scene out of what was going on in the West Bank. Palestinian Authority police and other military and intelligence personnel were largely cooperating with Israel's military. Even when the horrific and amoral murder of the Palestinian teenager Mohammed Abu Khader was followed by Palestinian riots and stone-throwing and arrests, the Palestinian Authority and Abbas were pretty calm. That is very interesting. I think it was because Israel, to a large extent, is strengthening Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, and Abbas and his allies by severely weakening Hamas in the West Bank. Abbas, of course, cannot ever say this, and he has the advantage of his new official alliance with Hamas to demonstrate his pan-Palestinian nationalism, but he is not at all unhappy that the Hamas operatives in every city, town, and village in the West Bank have been summarily rounded up by the IDF as they searched for the Israeli teens. I believe the brutal and horrible murder of the three Israeli teenage yeshiva students was not deliberately intended as a provocation by Hamas. They don't really have anything to gain by engaging with Israel right now. It is true, they are failing as leaders, and what they are really good at is terrorism. Whenever they send rockets into Israel, even when they fail to hit targets, they gain credibility with their own people. But Hamas also will suffer pretty severely from this unequal exchange with the powerful Israeli defense forces. At this point, I believe that Hamas would like nothing better than a ceasefire that frees some of the prisoners Israel has retaken, including ones released in the Gilad Shalit deal 2 years ago, and a chance to lick their wounds, crow about standing up to Israel, and work towards reestablishing a presence in the West Bank. Israel is now in a strange position. Officially, Operation Protective Edge, actually in Hebrew it could be translated literally as Hard Cliff, It is designed to end Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other fringe terrorist missile fire into Israel. Will it work? Well, no. at least not without the same kind of cooperation that Hamas gave Israel for the last 2 years, when it mostly stopped all other groups from firing rockets into southern Israel and stopped shooting them off itself, mostly. No nation on earth would tolerate its cities being subject to rocket attack without taking immediate military action to stop it. Imagine if Mexico were deliberately firing explosive rockets into Nogales, Rio Rico, Tucson, Phoenix, or San Diego. How long would it be before the U.S. Air Force blasted Mexico, and how much longer would it take before the U.S. Army invaded? Not long. But beyond the immediate goal of ending rocket attacks, Israel also has a greater agenda in mind, I believe. To deal Hamas a severe blow, to try to root out its military leadership from Gaza. Its civilian leaders now seem to be superseded by its military leaders, by the way, and to weaken Hamas enough to perhaps allow Fatah to actually resume control of Gaza. I personally don't think Bibi Netanyahu and Israel will succeed in rooting out Hamas or the Islamic extremist terrorists who rule the roost in Gaza now. And I am afraid that many more innocent civilians will die in the next few weeks. Perhaps I am wrong. I hope so. Perhaps Israel is only posturing in Gaza, seeking a return to the status quo before the Fatah-Hamas agreement and the kidnapping and triple murder. I'm pretty sure that Hamas would accept that status quo now, having demonstrated it has Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Dimona well within missile range. But it's never a good idea to underestimate just how fouled up things can get in the Middle East, or how quickly. We can, I suppose, only pray for peace. Sometimes that's the most effective approach. To play us in this morning, then, here is a Jewish-Arab song for peace in Hebrew and Arabic, Israeli and Arab singers. With our voices, we bring peace. May it only prove to be so. That was a Jewish-Arab peace song. We have nothing more beautiful than peace. True, if apparently quite distant now. One more thought about Israel. While our thoughts and prayers are with our brothers and sisters in Israel, undaunted but experiencing the fear of incoming rockets and the necessity of rushing into bomb shelters at a moment's notice in virtually any part of Israel, we must acknowledge that the horrible actions of those Jews who took prisoner and burned to death an innocent Palestinian Arab, a 16-year-old, are beyond all moral rules. They must be punished to the limits of the law. Their act was a horror, as profoundly against Jewish belief and practice as anything I have ever heard of. It has also done tremendous damage to Israel as well. And I must also express my personal and rabbinic disgust at the two border patrolmen beating an Arab teen caught on video. They must also be prosecuted by Israeli authorities now. Everyone needs to understand the difficulty of trying to remain civilized when faced with the brutality of a committed campaign of terror. We are Americans, living far from the epicenter of all of this, and we have no ability to really comprehend the experience. But Israel has retained the moral high ground by enforcing the rule of law, seeking to remain civilized in an uncivilized part of the world. If Israel fails in this, if we as Jews fail to remain civilized, we lose an important part of the moral foundation that is essential to our Jewish state. There are many debates we can have about the right strategy for dealing with dedicated Islamist terrorism, but none of those strategies involve burning teenagers to death or brutalizing 15-year-olds who are lying on the ground. Enough. Stopping this kind of conduct must be an extremely high priority for all of Israel's leadership. May sanity return speedily and soon. We can always hope and pray for it. There are very few people who analyze the world around us who are experts on Russia, China, the Middle East, and more, as Jonathan Adelman is. He'll get us caught up on some of the many changes going on in this unstable world in the summer of 2014 when we return on Too Jewish in a few moments.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Jonathan Adelman is a well-known expert in Middle Eastern international affairs, a full professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He received only 4 degrees from Columbia University, has written and edited 12 books. In the last year, he's had a number of op-eds all around the world on the Middle East, China, and Russia, some of which are his particular specialties. He's appeared regularly on television, written regularly for Huffington Post, Forbes, and other news outlets. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Rabbi Kahn.
This seems to me like a funny time around the world. I just returned from Israel. You know, everybody kind of knew what was going to happen in Iraq, and then suddenly the whole situation seems to be collapsing. What do you see from a macro level going on, particularly in the Middle East right now?
Well, I think the most important thing that's happening in the Middle East is that the United States, under President Obama, seems determined to withdraw from the traditional role that the United States has played as a great superpower during the Cold War and afterwards. And as a result, there's a power vacuum here, which is being exploited, first of all, by the groups like ISIS, extremist Sunni fundamentalists, and that has led to chaos in Syria and Iraq, even in Egypt and elsewhere. And secondly, there is something else that is new. In addition to that power vacuum, one other country that no one expected has begun to intervene, and that is, of all things, Russia.
Right.
And we just saw it. And it's amazing, it's not getting a lot of commentary here, but the Russians signed a $2 billion arms deal with the Egyptians. The last time they had anything to do with Egyptian arms was 1977. We saw the Russians winning in Syria with $4.5 billion. We just saw them the other day making a deal with Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq. So I think what's happened here is that the word has gone out in the Middle East and also in some other places that the United States is not going to intervene. And I'm not talking necessarily militarily, but using its weight to try to help pro-American secular forces in the region. And as a result, this has really emboldened the other side. And then the Russians have decided this is also an opportunity for them in a somewhat different way.
Is this a new Cold War sort of organically growing out there?
Not necessarily, for another reason that's important to remember. It's extremely unlikely that this will happen because if you go back to the days of the Cold War from 1947 to 1987, at that time the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe, that Russia then had an economy equal to 300 million people, but equal to 50% of the United States, and it had communism, which had in those earlier days some appeal, especially in the 40s and 50s. Today, all that's gone. Communism is gone. 50% of the former Soviet Union is gone. The Red Army has pulled as much as 1,000 miles back outside of the center of Europe, all the way for the defense of Moscow and St. Petersburg. And if you look at the economy, Rabbi Cohen, the difference is blazing. In other words, back then we're talking 50% of the American economy. Today, we would be talking about 13% of the size of the American economy. So there's just not they don't have the ideology, they don't have the military power, none of the economic power. They've got the kind of classic signs of a petrostate in which 80% of their exports are oil and gas. So that's what makes it even stranger. I was just in China. I came back 2 days ago. Now, if you want to say that China is a rising superpower in 20 years, absolutely. But Russia's got 2 trillion $3 trillion economy. It's the size of Canada. And yet the fact that the Russians can play this kind of powerful role tells you a lot about what happens when there's a power vacuum.
Fascinating. We will talk much more with Professor Jonathan Edelman when we return here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. It's been a challenging time in Israel and for Jews everywhere who care about Israel, which is pretty much all of us. On that subject, we have a special contributor today. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from Dr. Wendy Weiss Kohan, her new poem, The American Flamingos.
The American Flamingos. Rockets were falling on Stay Road, and Naftali, Gilad, and Eyal were kidnapped and shot and left to rot under a pile of rocks on a slope in a field. Rockets rained down upon Stay Road, and an Arab teen was kidnapped and burned to death and paraded under a flag in the city. Rockets fanned beyond Stay Road and hit the beautiful places, Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. And children played inside 100 of sheltered squared feet. Rockets spread throughout the country. But here, in the National Zoo, a pair of fuzzy flamingos were born, and their picture, warm in the glow of incubator lights and lenses, spanned across the U.S. news.
That was the new poem, The American Flamingos, by Dr. Wendy Weiss Kohan. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Ukraine has been very much in the news for a while, as has Russia and some degree the Jewish community that remains in Ukraine. What's going on there now? It's beginning to drop back because of all the other news, but tell us a little bit about Ukraine's resolution, if there is such a thing.
Well, I think the situation is far from being resolved, but one overall rubric, or maybe prism through which this can be viewed, is the prism of redrawing borders and how borders are at best temporary, imperfect, and artificial, and how often borders need to be or are simply de facto redrawn. So what seems to be going on in Ukraine now is that Putin realized that he overstepped his bounds, has basically withdrawn active support, as far as we can tell, from the rebels and the separatists who want to join Mother Russia or secede from Ukraine or escape central government control there. And the Ukrainian military has acted with renewed vigor in recent days to push back the rebels. So they seem now to be retreating to two major urban strongholds in the eastern part of Ukraine. One is Donetsk, and the other, I think, is Luhansk. I'm not as sure of that one. And that will be where they fight, you know, Custer's last stand. What will happen is not entirely predictable, but it looks like Ukraine will remain a united country, minus Crimea.
Minus Crimea, right.
Right. Ukraine obviously has an important, even unique place in Jewish history, in the sense that not only was it the home of Shalom Aleichem and...
Sorry. I have his statue up on the, you can't see it, radio viewing audience, but it's on my mantelpiece right here.
Right.
Wendy bought it for me.
And the home of lots of founders of Hasidic dynasties, and the scene of much of what we envision as shtetl life in the 18th and 19th centuries. And of course, the origin of many of our grandparents and great-grandparents. I mean, a right. huge percentage of the American Jewish community traces its roots to what is now Ukraine.
Yeah, the Pale of Settlement, which mostly was Ukraine.
Right. You know,
the Fiddler on the Roof group is right. from there.
So there are lots of descendants of these Jewish communities, lots of important Jewish properties, former or current synagogues, cemeteries, et cetera, et cetera. And it does matter in some sense whose hands they are in. Is it, are they in Ukraine's hands? Are they in Russia's hands? Will there be stability? It looks like Ukraine wants to be more firmly rooted in the West. Moscow clearly opposes that, has warned of dire consequences if a trade agreement with the EU is concluded, which shows really once again how paranoid and xenophobic Moscow's leaders are. But the situation seems to be resolving itself favorably. It's too soon to tell, and I hate making prognostications because I don't have a special crystal ball, but we can keep our fingers crossed that this is one story which will end relatively quickly and relatively happily.
At least relatively peacefully. Tom, thanks. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Erwin and Marie celebrated selling their raincoat business by going on safari in Africa. One night in the jungle, they were frozen in their tracks by an ominous low roar. "Marie," quaked Erwin, "I heard." "Shah, look behind me. Tell me, what do you see? A lion? A tiger? A leopard?" "I should know," moaned Marie. "What am I, a furrier?" Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. On a visit to Istanbul, Turkey a few years ago, I visited Topkapi Palace, center of power for the mighty Ottoman Empire from 1450 to, 1919 or so. More than 400 years in which they dominated a huge portion of the globe. I had not been in Istanbul in 16 years. They have a new section of the large museum within Topkapi's ancient walls. It's called the Chamber of Sacred Relics. While Topkapi Palace is literally filled with rooms and objects of historical and religious importance, carefully curated with dates and sources, this particular area is actually put together by a Muslim religious agency. It includes what can only be called a collection of pious forgeries and frauds. As tourists shuffle past the elegantly lit displays arrayed behind thick bulletproof glass, they learn that they are viewing the cooking pot of Abraham, the turban of Joseph, Aaron the high priest's breastplate, King David's armor, and Muhammad's sword and tooth, plus a hair from his beard. I think they might also have had a footprint of Noah's in preserved rock. In imitation of the medieval Christian veneration of fake religious objects in ornate reliquaries, each of these pseudo-relics is reverently preserved with an appropriate biblical verse from the Tanakh or New Testament or Quran. Each is treated as though it were the Hope Diamond or a Sultan's bejeweled coronation robe. It is all quite ridiculous. I mean, next door you can see amazing actual jewel-encrusted thrones that sultans really used. Why waste your time with all these obvious fakes? But what is notable is that the most impressive object among all these faux elements of supposed religious history is the Staff of Moses. Now, in its Turkish fraudulent incarnation in this museum, this staff is a golden rod about waist high with entwined serpents on it and both a majestic and slightly dangerous mystical look to it. In truth, in the Torah, this Moses staff is a mysterious object. When Moses carries it into the wilderness of Sinai as a young shepherd, it is just a wooden stick. But he learns from God in the burning bush episode that it will turn into a snake if cast on the ground. And when he does this before Pharaoh, it turns out that Pharaoh's magicians also can work the same trick. But then Moses' snake stick actually swallows theirs. The same matez used by Moses under God's direction to part the Sea of Reeds to allow the Israelites to cross, and then is lowered to drown the Egyptian pursuers. It is the stick used to strike the rock and bring water to the thirsty tribes, and it is held up in Moses' hand to help the Israelites triumph over their enemies in war. This powerful, multi-purpose staff even proves to be Moses' undoing, for when directed to talk to a rock instead of hitting it late in life, he can't resist whacking the stone with a stick to bring forth water, and so he loses his entry ticket to the Promised Land. In short, Moses' mate is an amazing tool indeed, and you can see why the fakers at the Chamber of Ancient Relics want to claim its power for their own. But that omits one crucial detail. That mate of Moses, that staff, is really just a stick. It's only when God chooses to command him to use it that it becomes something much more. Which brings us to this week's Torah portion of Matot. The name comes from one of the two words used in the Torah for a tribe of Israel, mate, which means rod. In fact, the other word, shevet, means branch. Both are really references to the staffs used to designate officials who lead the people, branches of Moses' own staff of authority. As we near the conclusion of the book of Numbers, which means nearly the end of the actual narrative of the journeys of the Israelites through the wilderness to the borders of the Promised Land, Moses is instructed by God to have the Israelites make a census of the tribes of Israel, a new count for those who are to enter Israel and make it their homeland. In Matot, the tribes are arranged and a census taken according to their staffs, like Moses' own staff, his mateh. In effect, they are counted by their sticks. But like Moses' magic staff, the importance, relevance, and effectiveness of these sticks is based entirely on how God chooses to use them. Our own sacred power, our magic, if you will, derives solely from God. We are all, in our own way, instruments of divine will. We only really count in this world when we serve God. A great lesson in this Torah portion of Matot. Well, it has been a tumultuous period in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe this summer, and most of us don't really understand the backstory that contributes to the headlines, but Professor Jonathan Edelman certainly does. We'll hear from him when we come back in just a moment on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Lost in all the news pouring out of Israel, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, the former Abu Mazen, compared the horrific murder of the Arab teen, Mohammed Abu Khader, to Auschwitz. As awful as it is, and it is horrible, this statement by Abu Mazen is a kind of obscenity in and of itself. Auschwitz-Buchenwald was where well over 1 million human beings were murdered and incinerated, most of them Jews, by the depraved actions of a modern nation-state. What happened last week was a depraved act by six horrible human beings who murdered one person. Unfortunately, this is a fascinating analogy for Mahmoud Abbas to make, since his own doctoral dissertation denied that Auschwitz really occurred. People, even the head of the Palestinian Authority, do say stupid things sometimes, don't they? Unfortunately, this kind of irresponsible and even immoral hyperbole diminishes the crime and tragedy of that poor teenager, rather than highlighting it. In the wake of all the news coming out of the Hamas-Israel showdown in Gaza, you may have missed this news item. We did. But on May 1st, Shelly Dadon, a 19-year-old Israeli girl from Afula, was murdered by an Israeli Arab taxi driver in what is now believed to be an act of Palestinian nationalist terrorism. The story reemerged this week when her family alleged the Israeli government covered up the terrorist and nationalist aspects of the brutal murder. The story itself is painful enough. Shelly Dadon, a pretty 19-year-old who had never been much beyond the city area of Afula, had a job interview in Migdal HaEmek, a new high-tech region of Israel, on May 1st. She hailed a cab to take her to the interview. Hussein Khalifa was the cabbie who picked her up. He later confessed to stabbing her 17 times and leaving her body in a parking lot. Last week, Khalifa was indicted for the murder, which the Shin Bet says was nationalistically motivated. We will continue to follow this story.
Paul Mazursky, the director of An Unmarried Woman and Down and Out in Beverly Hills, now brings to the screen a story from Nobel Prize-winning author Isaac Bashevis Singer. It is 1949. The nightmare of Nazi Germany is over, and Hermann Broder has come to New York City to begin a new life.
Jewish writer-director Paul Mazursky, filmmaker of Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Enemies a Love Story, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Harry and Tonto, and An Unmarried Woman, died last week at the age of 84. Mazursky, born in Brooklyn of Ukrainian Jewish ancestry, was a remarkably Jewish actor, writer, and director whose films often starred what he called my Jews, George Siegel and Richard Dreyfuss, both complicated guys. All the actors I worked with underneath it were me, some form of Jew. One of Paul Mazursky's last films was his self-funded, the whole budget, by the way, was $40,000, he proudly announced, 2006 documentary called Yippie, A Journey to Jewish Joy, about the annual Rosh Hashanah pilgrimage by Orthodox Jews to the grave of Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav in Uman, central Ukraine. Mazursky's films uniquely combine humor and drama in very Jewish ways. Paul Mazursky will be missed. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, Professor Jonathan Edelman, a past guest of Two Jewish that we always enjoy talking to. He's an expert in Middle Eastern international affairs, author and editor of 12 books, full professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. I don't know if I should say Condoleezza Rice's mentor. Is that correct?
Well, this PhD advisor, doctoral dissertation.
Doctoral dissertation advisor. That's pretty good nonetheless. He's also taught in Israel at Hebrew University and the University of Haifa. We were talking earlier about Russia and how small its economy is now as opposed to what it used to be, how weak its military is, and yet in a power vacuum, Putin's clear aggressiveness seems to have had an impact. You mentioned China. People think that China will pass the U.S. for the largest economy in the world pretty soon, actually, according to some things I've read. Is China? Does China also have military designs? Does it have military designs on Asia? Is it interested in becoming the sort of super military power again?
Well, it's not really interested as far as in the foreseeable future, the next couple of decades, in being a global superpower. But it has great designs on Asia. They're spending between $100 and $150 billion a year now in the military. I've given talks about six or seven times at People's Liberation Army. They're aware that they have a long way to go. They're still working on their first aircraft carrier. They don't have some of the advanced technology that we have today. But their biggest problem is the soldiers. I was talking to a general in the People's Liberation Army a couple years ago, and he was saying, look, our biggest problem here is that 70% of our soldiers come from the countryside. They're peasants. They're poorly educated. And the warfare today is high technology. And therefore, they're really working on this. But it's going to take them at least 10 years before they come up to snuff. And the result of that is that they are very focused, but focused on nearby Asia. In other words, South China Sea, East China Sea, Vietnam, Taiwan, their, you know, sphere of influence, so to speak. That's what they're focused on almost entirely today. So in other words, in the next 10 years, as they gradually pass the United States, but of course that's just in total GNP, per capita the gap is going to be like 5 to 6 or 6 to 1. This is going to be a major problem for the United States, and that's why you saw Shinzo Abe come out today, the Prime Minister of Japan. And make clear that Japan is not just going to defend itself, it's going to work with its allies in Asia, are also scared of the rise of China. So, and that's a really remarkable thing that hasn't happened, you know, almost ever.
Well, certainly, first of all, I don't think Japan has ever worked very well with the other countries in Asia. But also, of course, Japan has this whole peace focus in its constitution. It's not supposed to, you know, actively support military actions. And Abe, the conservative premier, is now saying, well, you know, if we want America to defend us, we better not only participate in that alliance, but also actively work to defend with the other countries.
And one other important thing to note that not everyone has noted is the Japanese are among the leaders in being scared that the United States is withdrawing. And guess who their new quasi-ally is?
Yeah.
Russia. You've got Shinzo Abe twice in Moscow in the last year. Shinzo Abe, this is a right-wing Japanese nationalist who really doesn't like the Russians. And guess who was sitting next to Vladimir Putin at the Winter Olympics? There was Shinzo Abe. I mean, the world is really, Rabbi Cohen,
changing
in a remarkable way. Yeah.
Let's talk about the Arab Spring, which became the Arab Summer, Arab Winter, and God knows what it is now. The hopes of most of those revolutions, the Facebook revolutions and so on, was that there was going to be some rise in democracy in the Arab world. Unfortunately, democracy often elects Islamic fundamentalists, whether they're Sunni or Shia. Tell us a little bit about what your perceptions are about where if there is such a thing as the Arab world is going right now.
Well, I think you summarized it rather well. I mean, I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that we as Americans and as Westerners and as Jews love democracy for all the good reasons. and the right reasons. The problem in this part of the world is that you need an economic base for political superstructure. And the bottom line is, if you look at the economies in these countries, like in Egypt, for example, or in Syria, it's under $4,000 GNP per capita. It's not even 10% of what we have in the United States or in Western Europe. And so you don't have that strong middle class. You don't have any history of tolerance. You don't have a good neighborhood for all of this. And so what's happening here is that empowering the population is empowering a group of people that are poorly educated. You get in Egypt, for example, 40% of the women are illiterate. In Iraq, 60% of the women are illiterate. And so given all of that, it's not exactly surprising that this in their full bloom, they are bringing forth radical regimes that are very hostile to what we like and what we want to see in this part of the world. And you notice something else even more frightening in a sense is that the real action isn't just a radical Islamic fundamentalist movement, but several of them.
Right.
You see, al-Nusra is busily fighting, you know, and it's a quasi-Al-Qaeda, and then it's fighting with ISIS, and then there's other versions of this. That tells you where the action is in that part of the world. And that's very difficult right now, even more so because the United States, as I said, historically played a significant balancing role in the region. That balancing is basically, you know, diminishing rather quickly.
Is it still possible for any superpower to impose much of anything on an Arab world that's become really kind of chaotic?
I think it's difficult, but it's not impossible. If you look at Syria, for example, 3 years ago, there was a real shot for the secularists to win. And we didn't take that. We refused to back them. We saw that in Iran with the Green Movement, when again, we saw a basically pro-Western secularist movement trying to overthrow the Islamic fundamentalists. And again, we didn't support them. So the word is out in the Middle East. If you're secular, if you're one of those people who actually believes in Western values, the United States, and I'm not trying to demonize Obama, I understand where he's going. He basically, because he's made it very clear that he thinks that the United States has committed, you know, errors in the Middle East, crimes, you know, elsewhere around the world, and he wants to withdraw, and he has this, I think, very naive belief, which is where your line of thought goes also, that if we just leave the people to themselves, everything is going to be okay. Well, that may be true in France. That is true in England and Japan. We're not worried. And in Israel. But it's not true when you get out of the first world countries, which have already gone through their painful adjustment today. So I think we can do things even now, but it's getting late in the game. And I think the sign of all of this is that the Russians are back.
We were standing on the Golan Heights recently, looking out towards Quneitra, and looking into Syria, where there was smoke rising, and I don't think anybody was burning a field in June. There was clearly some kind of fighting going on. The Syrian civil war, which was going to overthrow Assad in 10 minutes, and then Assad was going to win, and now people are predicting it's going to go on for years. Is there a right side in all of this now that the forces opposing Assad seem to have become so radicalized?
It's a very difficult issue. And as you know, I'll be in Israel next month, and the Israelis themselves are arguing over this question. Because the problem is that ISIS in the long run, obviously, is very bad for Israel. If they, with the radical Sunni fundamentalists, win, then this is a problem. But if you read their declaration, and I would encourage everybody to read it, not that we want to read this, but as they just pronounced the caliphate for Iraq and Syria,
right.
I think one of the things that's interesting from our Jewish and our Israeli point of view is, and I'm sure you noticed, we didn't occupy almost any space in that. We got a kind of passing mention as the third most hated factor in the world. And hey, what's the matter? We can't be number one.
Yeah, how we're slipping.
Yeah, we won 192 Nobel Prizes. We can win one of these, right? So the bottom line is that when you look at that, their focus, interestingly enough, is really not on us in the short to middle term. So the result is that, and they're going to have serious problems here. And some of what's going on is actually even good for us. Two things are good. One is to see the Kurds moving towards independence in northern Iraq. As you know, the Kurds have been very strongly pro-Israel. I've talked to people who've been there. I've even talked to Kurds myself, pro-American, and kind of dividing up Iraq into three places, with a Kurdish north, a kind of Sunni center, and a Shiite south, is not bad for us, because Iraq has become Iran's closest ally under Nouri al-Maliki. And given their oil power, and given the wealth that they have, that's very dangerous for Israel. So the bottom line is, I would hate to say this, but let me just tell something real quick about the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. You may remember that that war went on for 8 years. And during that war, unfortunately, 1 million people were killed or wounded or taken captive and so forth. And I remember talking to a Jordanian woman who was taking my class. And I asked her about the Iran-Iraq War. And she said, it's a real pity that it's coming to an end. I looked at her. It's a real pity? She said, yeah, because look, let the two countries that hate us fight each other for as long as they want, but we're making money out of this while this is all going on, and we're safe. And we have some of that issue here, that if the other side, different factions, which all may hate us, or mostly, but want to kill each other for a lengthy period of time, even for decades, that's not all bad. Syria now is weakened seriously. It's going to be divided. It's clear now, which wasn't clear, you know, a few weeks ago. Is that bad from Israel, that Syria isn't going to have the military capability, which they probably didn't have to begin with, but now, however diminished it is compared to 40 years ago, it's going to be diminished even further as it gets split up between different factions. It's complicated. It's not clear what the answer is for that. It's a very good question. And like, you know, all Jewish discussions, the questions are important.
Obviously. Another difficult question. You know, in some ways, Israel's in the best position it's been in for a very long time. There's no existential threat from Syria. There's no existential threat from Egypt. Certainly not from Jordan. Lebanon is barely even a state. Really, they're surrounded by weak neighbors. And while there's still grave concern about Iran getting nuclear capacity, in some ways, Israel has less to worry about than it has had in a very long time throughout its existence. In another sense, the asymmetrical problem of dealing with terrorism and Hamas and Hezbollah and very different people on other sides of Israel is very complicated. So is this a better time to be Jewish in Israel or worse? We need to know if we should be afraid or happy.
Isn't that the Jewish dilemma? I mean, if you think about it, I mean, who...
Start worrying, details to follow.
No, absolutely. I wrote an op-ed on this recently called, for Israel, it's the best of times and it's the worst of times. And it's exactly around that. It is, for all the reasons that you just enumerated, in some ways, one of the best of times, not even to talk about the high-tech revolution, to talk about, you know, the Nobel Prizes Israel is winning and how Israel, you know, has been selected, even by the chairman of Google as the likely number two high-tech center in the world. And it's also the worst of times. So I think, you know, basically it's both at the same time, but I have a little more concern than you just elaborated on. I kind of differ on only one thing. I think Iran is a much more significant threat. I don't see this administration, I know many Israeli officials are worried too, as really making the kind of agreement that will destroy the bulk of their, you know, nuclear infrastructure and ICBMs to follow. And I think that kind of, to me, means it's also the worst at times, because we are facing an oncoming existential threat unless the United States gets tougher. Now, it's possible, because it's not in Israeli, just Israel's interest, it's in American interest. Because as the New York Times said recently, by 2020, I mean, that's close. Within 5-6 years, Iran will have ICBMs. They already have had multi-stage rocket launches twice into space. With that, they will be able to threaten the United States with nuclear weapons, which would mean that any kind of, you know, deterrent effect that the United States might have, say by declaring that Israel is part of its zone or something like that nuclearly, will be gone, because the United States will start facing that threat. So I'm a little more worried. I think I agree with everything else, but I think we should worry a little more about Iran. It's kind of getting under the radar screen because so much else is going on, but we have not been holding their feet to the fire when you look at the daily reports out coming for the negotiations, and that really worries me. I'm not saying they would necessarily attack us, by the way. I think the greatest danger is if they have nukes, there could be an accidental nuclear war, such as the Geese over Norway incident in 1988.
Accidental or otherwise, nuclear war, of course, is terrifying to everybody on the planet. I want it, especially for Israel. It really is. Fantastic, but small. I want to thank Professor Jonathan Edelman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. What's the best place for people to find out more about your work and your writing?
Just go online.
Search Jonathan Edelman. He's everywhere.
I've done 30 op-eds in the last 2 years in the places that you mentioned, so there's a lot there. Or you can just write to me at jedelman@du.edu, and I'll put you on my distribution list for new articles and things that I write.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Doug Cohn, editor of a new book on Jewish responses to Alzheimer's and dementia. Our playout this morning comes from a singer named Daria, and it's a song for peace. Shalom Salam. We pray and hope for it to come to Israel speedily and soon. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we deeply pray of peace.